Welcome to the Council of Trent podcast, a production of Catholic Answers.
And welcome to another episode of Free for All Friday here on the Council of Trent podcast. I am your host, Catholic Answers apologist and speaker Trent Horn. And today we are talking about business deals that went bust. When I was recording this podcast, I perused through the news a little bit and saw that MoviePass has gone out of business and there are no plans to revive it in the near future. To which I said, well, who couldn't see that one coming? And yet, throughout the history of business and commerce, especially I'm talking about more modern businesses that we can analyze and see what went wrong, there are a staggering number of bad decisions that people make that ultimately lead to the ruin of companies, or at least a big black spot in their PR history or in their business history that's been overcome. Because some businesses that make blunders do recover from them, but others, unfortunately, do not. And that is what I want to talk about today here on the Council of Trent podcast. And a quick reminder, go to TrenthornPodcast.com for our extra bonus content, access to the Catechism and Church History Study Series, my new Trent Tracks, How to Prove the Deity of Christ in an Hour or Less, and other wonderful bonus content and great things to help keep our podcast going to reach more people, edify them, and build them up. But today, Friday on the podcast, we need to be edified. We need to be built up in our faith. But every now and then, it's nice to have a little bit of fun and learn something new about the world. And that is what I want to do today, where I will talk about business deals that went bust. So let's start with the first one. Let's start with MoviePass, all right? So according to Wikipedia, MoviePass was an American subscription-based movie ticketing service, majority owned by Helios and Matheson Analytics. Helios and Matheson are a data analytic firm. They are not in the movie business. They're not in the cinema business. And that starts to explain what went wrong with MoviePass. So I'll continue. Founded in 2011 and headquartered in New York City, the service allowed subscribers to purchase up to 3 movie tickets per month for a monthly fee. The service utilized a mobile app where users check into a cinema and choose a film and showtime, which resulted in the cost of the ticket being loaded to a prepaid debit card, which was used to purchase the ticket from the cinema as usual. The service went through several pricing structures following its original invite-only launch, including those limited to 2 or 3 films per month and unlimited plans with pricing based on market size. So during this time, the idea of MoviePass is, all right, you pay one fee and you get to go see movies. So you pay one fee, you get to go see 3 movies. Or maybe you want to purchase an unlimited plan. But those original unlimited plans for MoviePass, you pay one monthly fee, you get to see however many movies you want. I think they range, there's something like $75 in major markets. Now, if you go to more rural markets, where I think MoviePass is hoping to take off more in small towns and small cities, you don't have to pay as much. I remember when I went to see Avengers Endgame, I was in Bismarck, North Dakota, because I was finishing my master's degree in bioethics. And, you know, that was when the final symposium was. I had to be there. So I traveled there. And then I raced from the symposium to the movie theater where I'd reserved my ticket. And I posted the tickets online to show people, Avengers Assemble. And the most comments I got were people said $5.95 for a night showing of Avengers Endgame. Well, that's what cost of living, my friends. You live in Bismarck, North Dakota, things are cheaper because not a ton of people want to live there. I love going to Bismarck when I visit, usually in sometime between May and September. Oftentimes, though, I've spoken in Bismarck in December and January, and oh boy, it is another experience entirely up there. Only the hardiest people can endure that. Though I think it's even worse in northern, the tippy top of Minnesota, I think is actually even colder than North Dakota. But so, you know, you go to rural areas, you can get movie tickets, you know, in the evening, $6, $7. Here in San Diego, or especially in like San Francisco or New York, you're paying out like $20 sometimes to go and see a movie if you add on IMAX and 3D, all that stuff that I don't like. Just give me my movie. But the idea with the original unlimited plan for MoviePass was you pay $75 a month, you get unlimited movies. And so that means you'd have to see at least like, I don't know, 6 in most places, 5 or 6 movies a month to make it worthwhile. Most people don't go see movies that much. So you would think maybe the MoviePass would make money. It's just like a gym membership. How do gyms make money? How does my gym make money off of me? Well, by the fact that I don't go there as much as I should. That's most people. Gyms could not survive if they were the only people who paid memberships were the people who went. They live off of the absentee vampire membership that you're paying the gym, but you're not availing yourself of its service. If everybody went to a gym who had the membership, it would be completely crowded. You could never use the equipment. They bank on people not going. And that's what MoviePass tried to do, saying, hey, you pay $70 a month. You're not going to go see more than five movies a month. You're not going to do that. But then here's the problem. Before announcing in August 2017 that it would switch to offering a plan with a single film per day priced at $9.95 per month. And that is where MoviePass went completely off the rails. That they thought that, okay, we're going to offer a plan. You pay, I mean, imagine this. You pay $9.95 a month and you can see one movie a day every day of the month. How does that work? How could it possibly work? Because in many places, like here, if I go in the evening to see a film, it's going to cost me $13, $15. So even if I go see one film, MoviePass is going to lose money because MoviePass pays the movie theater. They do not work. They're not a part of AMC or Regal or Harkins. Harkins is a throwback to Arizona. If you're my Arizona listeners, you know what Harkins is. I don't think they got beyond Arizona. And that was my first job, actually. My very first job, I was 16 years old. I was the ticket taker at Harkins Movie Theaters. We were talking about this last night, my wife and friends, about going to the movies. I remember a lady walked in with a giant salad, and I said, ma'am, you can't bring outside food or drink. And she said, well, who's going to stop me? And I thought to myself, well, not me. I only make $5.75 an hour. I'm not going to get a fight with you over your Cobb salad. Go on in, lady. I feel bad for everyone else around you here eating your salad in the middle of the movie theater. But so the thing with MoviePass is they have to reimburse the movie theater when you use the service. So I pay $9.95 a month. Even if I see only one movie, MoviePass has to pay AMC $14 that month. That means they have a net loss of $4. How can they make money? How is it possible? Well, here's an interview on CNN Business with Frank Pallotta and the CEO of MoviePass, Mitchell O, and he tries to explain it.
It's kind of like you're losing money with every new subscriber. How is this a viable business plan?
Whenever you offer an all-you-can-eat program, the first couple months, people go crazy. People want to see every movie that comes out. You know, eventually you're going to get back to a normal level. The reality is people are going a lot more than they used to, but it's not as much as you would imagine.
What's the catch?
The catch is that over time, you're going to get offers and proposals from us buying the soundtrack of the movie as you walk out of the theater. We are going to use our understanding of you as the customer to be able to give you relevant suggestions that you might find valuable in your life.
So that's the idea, is that MoviePass is run by an analytics firm, Helios and Matheson. So they're trying to make money thinking, okay, even if we make money, we lose money on the ticket sales, we'll get information from your habits, your purchasing habits, to sell that to third markets, to sell to movie theaters, sell it to advertisers. And they thought that they could make money that way. And so in order to survive, they just relied on infusion of cash from investors saying, we just got to get through this rough period, got to get through this difficult period where we're losing money. Then once we get past that, we'll be all right. Well, they never got past that point. AMC Movie Theaters was threatening not to honor MoviePass, and they didn't honor it. They blacked it out for certain high-end movies. MoviePass eventually had to shut down the service temporarily. They would prohibit you from buying tickets for movies that were really high in demand from overwhelming the system. So ultimately, it didn't work, and the movie theaters themselves came up with an alternative. So AMC has A-List. AMC, I forget the specifics, but you can go pay a monthly fee, see a certain number of movies at AMC, and that is genius for the movie theater to do. Because here's the thing. Let's say AMC has a deal. I don't know what it is for A-List. Let's say it's $20 a month, I get to see four movies a month there. Even if it was unlimited, like one movie a day. Here's the thing. If I go to AMC, even if I don't go, if I don't use all of my ticket, the seat there, it ends up being empty anyways. An empty seat in a theater does them no good. It's good for them to get people in, even if it's at a discounted rate. Because here's the thing. When you get in there, they don't make the money off the movie ticket. That's not how they make their money. They make their money off the concession. It's like a 5,000% markup to get popcorn and soda. And I remember I used to work in concessions until I was so bad at math, they had to let me go. I just remember the thing I do remember once in concessions, this lady, she was so dead serious to me. It has to be a diet caffeine-free Coke. Please, sir, check. It has to be a diet caffeine-free Coke, young man. And she was just so ornery with me. I'm like, oh, fine. And I'm trying to get the order together. And I give her all the stuff. And she walks away. And then I look down under my station and I saw the diet caffeine-free Coke under there. I sipped a little. I'm like, yep, that's diet caffeine-free Coke. And I thought, oh, she's going to come back and rip into me. And she never did. So either she didn't notice, so it's not a big deal, or she died of some terrible allergic reaction, and I never found out about it. So that's the thing. So MoviePass ultimately failed because the movie theaters could do this same subscription-based service through them. And if you go see the movies, they can easily absorb the cost of you sitting in the seat. In fact, they want you to come a bunch during the month so you can order popcorn. Because if you think to yourself, oh, if the movie is free in your mind, you already paid a subscription fee and you walk into the theater, you're way more likely just to buy popcorn because you think you're going to a free movie anyways. So why not spend $8 and get popcorn? Now, I don't think it's stealing because I get giant popcorn when I go to Reading Cinemas near me here. I get and they give you a free refill. So I get my refill, then I put that in a plastic bag, and I save it if I go back in a week, because it will stay. And my wife says that might be stealing, you're not supposed to bring outside food or drink in, but it's not outside food or drink. I originally purchased it there in the theater, I'm bringing it back. It was inside food and drink. And if you think that I am that cheap, that I am recycling my popcorn from the movie theater a week old, you would be right, sir. But that's how you got to get by in this day and age. So that's the first failure of MoviePass. According to Wikipedia, on September 13, 2019, MoviePass announced the service would shut down the following day. Parent company Helios and Matheson Analytics said it could not predict whether the service would ever return. If I had to bet my money on it, it probably won't. All right, here's the next one. New Coke. You remember this and New Coke? So back in 1985, when Coke celebrated the centenary, its 100th anniversary, they decided to change the flavor of Coke and not offer just an alternative flavor, but to change the formula itself, which is extremely controversial at the time. And the reason they didn't just offer New Coke as just a new formula was because the bottlers and manufacturers were already mad that Coke was giving them additional formulas, like, we need Diet Cherry Coke, we need this other flavor. They didn't want to deal with another new flavor, so they decided just to change the whole formula. And the reason Coke changed the formula was because they weren't doing well in taste tests with Pepsi. So in the 80s, brands and companies were really experimenting with marketing and brand advertising, and they would do these taste tests, and Coca-Cola would lose consistently in the Pepsi Challenge to Pepsi. And, you know, you would take a little sip and say which you like more, Pepsi or Coke. Pepsi would win almost every time. But here's the reason why. Pepsi is a sweeter drink than Coke. So if you have a sip of it, it tastes better than Coke. But the real test is to make someone drink a can of Pepsi and then make them drink a can of Coke and ask them which one they preferred more. And more people will tell you they would rather drink a can of Coke than a can of Pepsi because Pepsi's too sweet. It's definitely too sweet for me. I used to enjoy Pepsi my palate has really changed. When I was a kid, I liked Pepsi. Can't drink it anymore. It's too sweet. Even Coke is too sweet for me. There's only two kinds of Coke that I can... Now I sound like some kind of old curmudgeon. Like, there's only two kinds of Coke that I can drink. I can drink a McDonald's Coke and a Coke in a bottle that says Echo in Mexico. I love Coke in a bottle. But honestly, the brand I love now is Dr. Pepper, because I think Coke is even too sweet for me. I'll drink a Dr. Pepper. Other brands I enjoy are RC Cola, Royal Crown Cola. You can only get that every now and then, and that's a delightful treat every now and then when you have that. Though the one Coke I do like, you got to try this. It is a revelation. Peach Coke. Bottled, peach-infused Coca-Cola. My friend, you will not regret it. So this podcast is sponsored by Coca-Cola and Audible and, you know, whatever they get sponsored by. So that's what happened with New Coke. They were losing in the challenge to the Pepsi Challenge. They changed the whole formula in 1985. And a lot of people actually did like it, but it was not, there was a group that really hated it, and that was people in the South. They are very fond of Coke. Coke is a big part of their heritage, and the idea of changing it was seen as Northerners invading their space, and they were none too happy. And some people liked the new taste, but a lot of others didn't. For example, in 1985, the Times food critic Mimi Sheraton described the flavor of New Coke this way. But I've never had New Coke. So if you've had New Coke, if you've actually drank the stuff, leave a comment under the video. I'd love to hear if you liked New Coke or not. She described it this way. It's sweeter than the original formula and also has a body that could be described as lighter. It tastes a little like classic Coca-Cola that has been diluted by melting ice. Well, that doesn't sound appetizing. But notice what they're trying to do. They make it sweeter to try to catch up with Pepsi in the taste challenge, but it didn't quite work. So here is some retro commercials to give you an idea of what it was like when New Coke debuted in 1985.
Introducing the new taste of Coca-Cola. In this country, the best have a way of getting better, and Coke just did. From today, there's a new taste, a new standard against which colas will be judged.
Coke is me. Management of this company honestly and truly reveres our consumers more than we revere a century-old formula. I've never been as confident about a decision as I am about the one we're announcing today.
Well, today, Coke announced a new real thing, a change in its formula. And as Mike Jensen reports, Pepsi said baloney.
Pepsi is giving its employees the day off to celebrate. Pepsi says by today's action, Coke has admitted that it's not the real thing.
All cola drinkers of America, thank you for participating.
Please don't change the taste of Coke. Fix it. It ain't broke.
They can't do it. That's un-American because we fought wars to have a choice, to have freedom.
I love that. You can't do this. It's un-American. We fought wars for this stuff. How dare you? And Pepsi really took advantage of this. So Pepsi is like, oh, Coke's trying to catch up to us. Oh, Coke, you're not going to be able to do it. So they ran their own commercials. Let me find one here.
Can somebody out there tell me why Coke did it? Why they changed? First, they said they were the real thing. Then they said they were it. Then kablooey, they changed. So now, I'm going to try my first Pepsi. But I still want to know why Coke changed. Now I know why.
Pepsi, the choice of a new generation.
I really miss these older commercials that sound more like public service announcements. You know, it's just more like someone just talking to you. It's not flashy. It's not sexy. It's just Pepsi's the choice of a new generation. Don't you want to make that choice? Well, yes, I do want to make that choice. Oh, gosh, it's too sweet. Give me a Coke or a Royal Crown Soda or something like that. So this has given rise, though, to conspiracy theories. Some people will say that Coke changed the formula as a reverse psychology trick to get people to like Coke more. And the Coke CEO has said, we're neither smart enough nor dumb enough to think of an idea like that. Others said that they changed the flavor and changed it back to hide the fact that they went from sugar to high fructose corn syrup. But since 1980, a lot of Coke bottling manufacturers were using high fructose corn syrup. So that's not, they just made a bad error here. I think it's called Hanlon's Razor. I think I've talked about it on the show. Never ascribe to malice what can be ascribed to stupidity. So that's what happened with New Coke. Though I love a bit in the article on New Coke, it says, the fiasco led Bill Cosby to end his longtime advertising for Coca-Cola. Cosby claimed that his commercials praising the superiority of the new formula had hurt his credibility. Well, now it seems like Coke's probably thanking themselves that they haven't had Bill Cosby shilling for them for the past 20 years. Well, you need to get your Coca-Cola and your Kodak film and your Jell-O pudding, and I deny those allegations against me. Theo, you need to graduate already. So that is the new Coke debacle. Oh, here's another one. American Airlines Universal Pass. So American Airlines I think this was back in the 1980s, was not doing really well. It was in 1981 they launched this. They launched the American Airlines Pass. The program, now rebranded as AirPass, initially enabled pass holders unlimited first-class travel on any of the airline's flights worldwide. Lifetime membership was priced at $250,000 with the option to purchase a companion pass for an additional $150,000. So back in 1981, you could buy an American Airlines AirPass for you and a guest, $400,000. And you could have unlimited first-class travel for the rest of your life because they desperately needed cash. Now, that was a lot. I mean, back in 1981, $400,000, that would easily put you up somewhere like, I don't know, like $1.2 million, something like that. But here's the problem with that, though. They sold six. So that's expensive. Only really rich people are going to get that. And some people did. Michael Dell of Dell Computers bought it. Willie Mays bought it. And I think Mark Cuban bought it. And he still has his AirPass. So these are people, though, if you look at, let's say they could do this the next 40 or 50 years, even flying first class travel all the time. They end up costing American Airlines millions, millions of dollars more than what the pass was originally worth. There was a guy who bought it, and he would just travel to London for the day to have lunch with a friend and then fly back. And if he wanted a sandwich in Boston, he would go to a special pub there from Chicago and just fly like every day. You can imagine that adding up. And so they eventually stopped the pass. The program, the cost of the pass, let's see here, it was increased to $600,000 in 1990, then $1 million in 1993. But then the airline ended the sales, the unlimited pass, in 1994, except for a one-time offer in the Neiman Marcus Christmas catalog. $3 million for a pass, $2 million for the companion pass. None were sold. Because at that point, if you spend $5 million to get those passes, you could buy a Cessna. You could buy a private jet. You don't need to fly first class. You could, for $5 million, you could buy your own jet, basically, and jet set around. So no one's going to buy the pass anymore now that private jet travel has become cheaper and these kind of unlimited passes are way too expensive. There was a story, though. One of the guys who bought the pass, it was revoked because he bought a companion pass. And it wasn't for a designated companion, so he would put a fake name down, and he would just take a friend, you know, girlfriends. He would just take random strangers. Like, if someone missed their flight, he'd say, I have a companion pass, fly with me. So he just would always put, like, these fake names down, and American Airlines caught him and said that's a violation of our terms of service, and his air pass was actually revoked. But that was definitely a blunder that cost the airline. I mean, they got, you know, a few million dollars back in the 80s, but those lost seats these people would book for the next 30 years ended up costing the company way more money. So if you're able to go back in time, you have a lot of money, go back to 1991, buy the American Airlines Universal Pass. But honestly, I'm not that big a fan of American Airlines. Anyway, they're fine, but I'm really more of a Southwest guy myself. I should do another episode just on Southwest Airlines. They have a pretty wonderful story, but we shall get to that soon. All right, here's the next blunder. Blockbuster not buying Netflix. This is from Business Insider. Former Blockbuster workers all over the world must cringe every time they hear the words online streaming and on demand. That's because back in 2000, Reed Hastings, who's the CEO for Netflix, approached former Blockbuster CEO John Antiocco and asked for $50 million to give away the company he founded, Netflix. Antiocco, thinking that it was a very small, niche business, ended the negotiations and didn't buy Netflix, which at the time was a DVD mailing service, according to Variety. Now Netflix, just short of being worth the same as CBS last year, soared past the television network owner with a $32.9 billion market valuation. So there was, I remember going to Blockbuster. There was a Blockbuster about a mile from my house, and I would spend, you know, it's funny, Netflix is now the virtual, it's the virtual Blockbuster, but it was the same thing. When you went to Blockbuster, you perused the aisles, you walked up and down the aisles to find what you wanted to check out. And that was just a fun experience in and of itself. You got out of the house, you were there, you walked around, you decided if you wanted to get, you know, Mike and Ike's along with it, and you never did, because you could just go across the street to the convenience store and get candy. Who would buy candy at Blockbuster? You just get the movie. And I remember going through, and what was great back then was that the movie covers, like the actual covers for the movies, were very artfully designed. They were interesting and fascinating because that got you to buy the movie. Now, every single cover is interchangeable. They're terrible. But I remember going through the store to watch it. Now, when you go on Netflix, you do the same thing. You do that browsing, but you're just going through on a remote. It's nowhere near as entertaining as actually getting out there. But Blockbuster, of course, didn't work, because, you know, you had to deal with actually going to the store. That was a big hassle. Sometimes the DVD or, well, the VHS tape might not work, you know, be kind, rewind, or the DVD could be scratched. It's like, oh, what do I have to deal with this? Or it's the wrong one in the box and you get home. And late fees. Don't get me started on late fees. In our house, always like, we got to get it back there. We're going to get charged a late fee. Like, they could charge you more than what the movie was worth. It was absurd. And so that led to a kind of apocryphal story about how Netflix got started in the first place. Now, I always thought that this was the story. I learned something new today. I always thought Reed Hastings started Netflix because he went to Blockbuster once and he got charged a $40 late fee for renting Apollo 13. However, according to another article, co-founder Mark Randolph, who left the company in 2002, said the tale was a convenient fiction to explain why the company was better than its competitors. Instead, Randolph claims the company was started when he and Hastings wanted to create the Amazon.com of something. They decided on shipping DVDs because customers were willing to buy them online and they were strong enough to mail. And so they set that up. However, the article goes on to say Hastings had always been vocal about his belief in streaming video. He said movies over the internet are coming, is what he told, I think, back in 2007. At some point, it will become big business. So we started investing 1% to 2% of revenue every year in downloading. And I think it's tremendously exciting because it will fundamentally lower our mailing cost. That's the key of great businesses, that they are future-oriented. They can think ahead to the future. Give you an example, Catholic Answers. So Carl Keating, the founder and previous president of Catholic Answers, founded it back in the 1980s. And here's the thing. In the 90s, he was reading about the internet. He would read trade journals, not popular magazines. He read trade journals. And he told Patrick Madrid, who was the VP at the time, he told him, hey, there's this new thing coming, the internet. It's crazy. You'll be able to order food and order it from the grocery store. And I think Pat Madrid thought that on the internet, you would go on your computer and there'd be a camera at the grocery store and you would pick the food that you want. And so it's like, well, what do you mean you could order stuff on the internet? How would that be possible? So Carl went to the earliest internet domain register and he registered Catholic.com. I mean, imagine getting that domain for any Catholic apostolate, wearecatholic.com. That domain is worth, I can't even imagine how much it is worth today. What any Catholic apostle, what the Vatican would love to have Catholic.com to redirect back to them. We're the number one, we're the number two visited website, Catholic website in the world. We're right after the Vatican, which is understandable. But that's an example of forward thinking. That it's through forward thinking that you're able to plan ahead. And unfortunately, Netflix has been guilty of not forward thinking because they have all this content, but now other providers like Disney Plus or Hulu will create their own streaming content. And Netflix was ahead of the competition, but they may not be ahead much longer anymore as other groups are going to catch up. So you always got to be one step ahead of the breadline, one swing ahead of the sword. I steal only what I can afford. That's everything. Yes, I watched the live action remake of Aladdin with my kids this past weekend. It was fine. Honestly, what made me mad, though, was Will Smith was great in it. What made me mad was Jafar. He's my favorite character, and he is terrible. Absolutely terrible. The worst Jafar I've ever seen. I said, you should have gotten Oded Faya. He was the guy in The Mummy, who's like the guy who protects the mummy's crypt or whatever. He's the Arabic guy, mysterious. That guy should be Jafar. Then it turns out in the TV show Once Upon a Time, he was cast as Jafar. I'm like, I knew I'm not the only person who could have thought of this. We'll do a Disney movies episode here pretty soon. All right, two more blunders. Next one, the E.T. arcade games. This is back during the Atari collapse in the early 1980s. Atari was big business. I had an Atari, though, of course, I had it. I still owned it after the collapse, which was in 1983. They were still selling Atari units. I was playing it probably in the early 90s. But there was a video game collapse because Atari saturated the market with a lot of terrible games. Nobody wanted to buy them anymore. Not just Atari, but other companies put games out there that were just awful, unplayable. And easily one of the worst ones by far is E.T. So based on the movie E.T., Atari worked with Spielberg and they tried in 1982. They started in July and they wanted the game out by Christmas. So the guy who developed, I think his name was Scott Warshaw, he had 5 weeks to program the game, and it's terrible. It's just E.T. hopping around, falling into holes, and collecting a telephone, and trying to phone home, and trying to run away from a man in a trench coat who looks like a child molester, but is really like the FBI trying to get him. It's just awful. Here is a clip from Conan O'Brien. He does this great segment called Clueless Gamer, where Conan plays modern games and also classic games, and it's pretty funny. So here's Conan O'Brien playing E.T.
All right, you fell in another hole. You just got to do the neck thing and get out.
So there's a lot of just falling in a hole and then extending my neck and floating out.
That's basically the whole game.
This just simulates the cycles of depression. The sound effects are fantastic. Listen. Fans wanted me to play?
Yeah.
Thank you, fans. Thanks for having me experience that. The fans asked me to play E.T. the Extraterrestrial. Let me rate it. If Flock of Seagulls is good, and Duran Duran is bad, I'm gonna give this a men at work. Figure it out. I did like Space Invaders. It was.
So he was playing the Atari Classic games there. And the game was one of the worst games of all time. In fact, the game was so bad, there was a rumor that in 1983, Atari buried hundreds of thousands of cartridges in a landfill in New Mexico. And in 2014, for the documentary Game Over, Atari worked with the New Mexico government, the state government, municipal government, went to the landfill, dug it up, because people thought it was an urban legend. Nah, they didn't really do that. But they did. In 2014, it was dug up, and they found... thousands of cartridges. They began. It was believed that there were 700,000 cartridges, but they ended up finding about 1,300 cartridges, which is still a lot of cartridges that were buried there. And some of them were excavated and were sent to a museum. And that's the documentary Atari Game Over, which I would definitely recommend for your viewing pleasure to find out about the dark night in games before Nintendo came along to save everything. And the last one, Kodak. this is about Kodak cameras. If your employee came to you, as the article says, if your employee came to you in 1975 and told you he'd invented the digital camera, what would you do? If you were Kodak, the answer was to effectively shove him in a closet and hope the product never reached the mass market. So Kodak had filed a patent for a digital camera in 1977 and never followed up on it, and they never followed up on digital camera technology. Instead, they stuck with regular Kodak film, and I use that stuff all the time. Here, I've got a, here's a clip though of, and people love Kodak back in the 70s and the 80s. Like my parents, even the 80s and 90s, like we were always buying the 35 millimeter film. Remember we had a 35 millimeter camera that we used, and we went to Splash Mountain and we put it in our bag off to the side to make sure it wouldn't get wet. And then by the time we came back, it was stolen. I do remember that. That's why I'm always hyper aware about my stuff getting stolen, because I was scarred as a kid. But we always bought the digital, the disposable cameras. I use disposable cameras up through like the mid 2000s. Like I remember using a disposable camera at my high school graduation party in 2003. And you go and they're like, do you want singles or doubles? I'm like, I'm not sharing this with people. Give me singles. You know, and you put, and then I put it up. Now eventually I've lost those prints. They're gone. I scanned them though. I did scan them to save onto copies of my old printed pictures, because they could fade over time. But back in the 70s, 80s, Kodak was king. Here's a commercial to make you feel like you got to get a... Imagine, you know, we take for granted all of us can take pictures whenever we want. We just take that for granted now with phones. But back then, they really sold you on the nostalgia, like you need a camera. So here's a 1977 Kodak commercial.
Next week, Ozzy and Harriet will be brought to you by Eastman Kodak Company. We went to Hartford, Connecticut, and picked out 10 people who had never before taken home movies. We gave each of them a new Kodak Brownie movie camera and a roll of Kodachrome film. We showed them how easy the camera was to use. Then we asked them to tell us how they made out with their very first roll. Here is what they said.
I never dreamed that movies were so easy to take. Actually, they were as easy as taking snapshots.
I love the older commercials like this, and I wish we had more commercials like that. But instead of investing forward thinking into digital camera technology, Kodak stayed with film as long as they could. That in the 70s they were, so this commercial was in the 50s. I apologize. I think I said this is a 1977 commercial. I actually couldn't load that audio, so I found this 50s commercial instead. But in the 70s they had, in the 80s, the digital camera technology, but it's still pretty rough. The image was not very good. And so the Kodak execs thought, this is never going to catch on. But then it did. But then, of course, I thought, okay, great, well, we'll get the digital cameras out there. We're going to be great until the iPhone comes along and you can take pictures on your phone. When I went places, there was a time, you know, I went from having a disposable camera to having a digital camera, and then finally just to having no camera and just relying on the one on my phone. So once again, it's all about being forward thinking. And that's what we try to do here at the Council of Trent podcast. I want to see where we're at as a church, peer ahead to see what objections, obstacles, challenges are coming at us down the road, and offer you guys answers, arguments, other things to help you address those and spread the gospel of Jesus Christ, and to have fun every now and then on Fridays, let our hair down and learn something new. And I hope you've enjoyed learning something new today, and I hope that you have a very blessed weekend.
If you like today's episode, become a premium subscriber at our Patreon page and get access to member-only content. For more information, visit TrentHornPodcast.com.